because of this Hong Kong connection. In 1980, it must be 84 or 83, I got a movie company owner, Mr. Reverend Shaw, to give $1 million Hong Kong to Stonebrook. It's now, he did give that money, and Marvel and I went personally to receive it. And it's now one of the funds in the
Humanity
Foundation.
I see.
And it's used to, it's called the Sir Reverend Shaw Distinguished Lectureship. And every year we invite a number of people to come. The idea is to let Stonebrook Foundation manage it, and we use half of the interest and dividend, and the other half is plowed back so that it can stand the inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And we use the half of the yearly proceeds to finance these lectureships. And currently we were first negotiating with the Orby to come on campus, the playwright.
Oh, I see.
But that collapsed because, not Orby is very interested in coming, but the theater department didn't want him because he had been here once before, and apparently he offended a number of people in the theater department. I didn't know this, so I already approached Orby, and Orby was very enthusiastic. But the theater department said that they would prefer somebody else. So I said, if you don't want him, of course we shouldn't have him. So they are now cooking up some new names. The previous ones had been, well, my idea, this is a new aspect of my life in the last 7 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that to raise funds is very important.
Yeah.
And I'm not a good fundraiser, but I did raise some funds.
One learns slowly.
And so after the Reverend Shaw Distinguished Lectureship was set up, the first one that we invited was Arthur Sackler. Now, Arthur Sackler was a very wealthy man. He unfortunately died half a year ago. He was reportedly to be worth $500 million. He, more importantly, he gave generously to educational institutions. He donated the Arthur Sackler Museum for Harvard, which just opened a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
He donated the Arthur Sackler Medical Building for Tufts, which just opened 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He donated the Arthur Sackler Museum for the Smithsonian to house his collection of Oriental and of Chinese and Near Eastern art. It opened last September. There's a big ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the Metropolitan, the where these Chinese Buddhas are kept,
mm-hmm.
is the Arthur Sackler Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And then where the Egyptian, there's a very large room on the northern side of the Metropolitan, where there's a rebuilt Egyptian tomb.
Then, well,
never mind. With a pool in front of it.
Yeah.
If you look at the wall, that is the Arthur Sackler. It's the wing is called by the names of three Sackler brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur Sackler, somebody. They were all psychiatrists.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he was the first Reverend Shaw Distinguished Lecturer. I invited him, and he was happy to accept. We gave him an honorarium of $2,000. Which he promptly gave to charity, but we gave it to him because that's according to our rules.
Yeah.
And the idea was to get him acquainted with Stonebrook, with the possibility that eventually he would give us some money. Unfortunately, he suddenly died last September, July,
mm-hmm.
before the opening. This was all set up that he would be, he would participate in the opening of his museum at the Smithsonian. But suddenly he died. The opening continued. The ceremony continued. I was asked to give a talk, but I couldn't go because just at that time my mother became very ill, and I rushed to Hong Kong, and she died in September. So I also did not participate in the Arthur Sackler Museum opening in Washington. But maybe we'll get something from Jerry Sackler, his wife. Mm-hmm. They have a foundation, yeah, which she manages.
Well, the foundation has grown and is performing many functions. George Collins, Ward Melville, and I were the three incorporators.
Is that right?
Yes.
By the way, George is still going strong.
Yes, he is, down in Virginia.
Yes.
I stayed overnight with him.
Oh.
Recently? Last year. 2 years ago.
Oh, I haven't seen him for quite a number of years. He was in Saudi Arabia back and forth.
Was he?
Hmm. Oh, he retired from Brookhaven.
Yes.
Then he moved to Georgia, to Virginia Polytechnic Institute.
Yes.
And then he retired from that. And in fact, I went to the ceremony when he retired there.
I see.
Then he went.
He was still there when I was there.
Yes, he's still there. But that retirement must be some 7 years ago or thereabouts from VPI. And after that, he got a job at one of the universities in Saudi Arabia. So every year he would spend quite a number of months there. I think he's retired from that too.
Okay.
And now he's back at VPI. But I understand he is still teaching.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I go to Florida and I stay with friends on the way down. And I have interviewed George. I have had him on tape too.
Give him my regards. As I told you, my first real encounter with Brookhaven was because George offered me a job there.
I see.
In 1953.
I left in 52. Well, this has been very, very interesting and broader than I had anticipated in many directions that I did not know about. I'm very glad you spoke the way you have.
Yes, it's a very important thing to put these things down.
Yes. You are number 46 now.
This is the 46th person we interviewed?
Yes, right. And I'm going to interview Alec on Friday.
Oh, very good.
Mm-hmm.
He was here.
Yes, I understood he was. I couldn't stay, unfortunately. But I understood he was. All right.
Aftermath of the sacking of Lee, and it was a delegation. And I think those were the three people. Maybe there was someone else along. Maybe Tom Irvine went along. I don't know. That was the day that the state of New York got put in serious risk of acquiring a major university on Long Island. Though it did not really feel it.
Well, that was either very late 61 or early 62.
Yeah. Well, it would have been the very earliest 62 because much into 62 it would not have been possible to recruit a graduate class. I have the flyer at home. I have about 8 copies of the flyer at home, which is, I think, a historic document.
You want to send me one?
I was looking for it just last week. I have a folder for them. My house is packed with papers. They're not organized. I will continue to look and send
you. All right.
They're very handsome, light gray and pink ink. Mm-hmm. Very classy looking. You would have thought the place was some serious university. rather than this fraudulent group in a dormitory. So all of those people were responsible. They got no help from anyone. There being no one there to help.
Porter came in just about that time.
Well, he was sort of commuting.
Yeah, right.
And I remember, I vaguely remember meeting with him. He, of course, was, at least in my dealings with him, was very inscrutable. Of course, he had a lot to be inscrutable about. I gather that, as you, I'm sure, have heard, I got to be somewhat comfortable with him later, and we had some very nice discussions. But apparently, his assignment to Stony Brook was torture to him. He just had a terrible time, and my heart really does go out. I'm sure everybody was very mean to him.
I don't think that he and Tom Hamilton saw eye to eye very closely. And he's Harry was an historian by background.
Yeah.
And really a very gentle kind of chap.
I think of him often.
Yeah.
I'm a gentle type of chap, even in spite of what I do from day to day.
Okay.
Who interviewed for the position here, that meaning Stony Brook?
Stony Brook, yeah. You've covered that.
Yeah, I came to the New York meeting in January of 1962 and met with everybody in the department, and we came back out to Long Island, and I looked around, and the weather was miserable is what I mainly remember, but we began to develop plans at that point. What was your understanding? Why did you come? What factors were most important in your decision? At that point in time, Sonny was a joke. You may remember it was pretty much a joke in the circles that I moved in. As for example, believe it or not, one of the few people, a few colleagues in St. Louis that I sought to talk about it with was Barry Commoner, who, believe it or not, I'm one of the few people who really likes Barry Commoner, the few people you'll ever meet. I admire his sense of systems and potential. I don't, scientifically, we're on different wavelengths, but he wouldn't even talk to me about it. He said it was a contemptible notion. It amuses me that Barry wound up at Queens. He is now retired from Queens, but at any rate, I mentioned one aspect that conditioned my thinking. It seemed to me that physics, which was the only thing I was interested in at that point, was at a crossroads. Academic physics was at a crossroads that, with the clear recognition now of the need to double the size of the higher education establishment, which had started in 58 in the latter part of the Eisenhower administration, and received very clear enunciation from Kennedy at the very beginning of his administration, that those states that had the biggest problem had a serious possibility of writing something new and very exciting. The research university business, and obviously New York was at that point the spectacular example of a rich, sophisticated, needful state that had incredibly delayed its decision making on how it was going to address the imperatives of public higher education. It seemed to me, in fact, I remember saying it,
Dewey had already taken the first step in 48.
But it was a non-step by agreement of everybody. Nothing would be done for 10 years. And as I understand it, there was a secret codicil that nothing serious would be undertaken. The risks were obvious. The state had no record of accomplishment. Such institutions as it had were either, when they were good, they were trivial. When they were bad, they were very bad. At least in physics and the sciences, the pretensions of the master plan, the 1960 master plan, were read as a joke. For
example, the first public speeches that I gave on Long Island was summoned to a meeting of the New York Physical Society, the New York chapter of the American Physical Society, at Farmingdale, that high-flying academic institution that operated the little storefront down there, to give my plans for the department. And I gave them a very serious talk about how there were going to be 50 faculty and 300 graduate students, and the university was going to have between 10 and 20,000 students, that I was pressing for 20,000. And we were going to do the following things. And we were going to be big in high energy. We were going to do nuclear physics. We were going to have a major strength in theoretical physics to complement Rickett. And they laughed. They laughed at me. Now, that was quite embarrassing, and that really wasn't my fault. But I must say I laughed since, because every word of it came true. Every damn word of it came true, and it came true in 5 years. Except for the 300, we never got over 130. But that's another story. We could have. It seemed to me, and I may have said to you, that when it became clear, as it was beginning to be clear by 1962, that Rockefeller was seriously intending to do this thing, and also had solutions for the obvious problems, namely the physical limitations. I then concluded it was going to happen. The plan was going to happen. And that in an enterprise of that magnitude, serious people burrowing away over in the corner, even if the whole organization was maligned, could probably get something done. I said that in those years as a joke. There was a little bit of prophecy in that, though.
Yeah.
But the attractions of Stony Brook, of course, are that at that point, where it is in the downstate part of this wonderful state, it is under the full supervision of a very sophisticated region, which knows what quality is, hasn't previously been interested in investing in it, but they damn well know what it is, that there would not be any risk of not being noticed.
Right, you were within hailing distance of Manhattan.
The New York Times is a very important object. And the New York Times doesn't give a rat's ass what's happening in Buffalo, but they sure care what's happening around them. I wish they cared a little more about what happens in New Jersey, but where we have some good news for them. But at any rate, it seemed to me that the state was indubitably going to move, that Rockefeller showed the direction in which the money could come from. It was not a matter of 10 sequential gambles on the legislature. He hocked the students so that he could build the place. Clever idea. Just brilliant. Do you know whose idea that was? Did you ever hear? John Mitchell. Isn't that something?
Attorney General.
Yeah. His credits were in bond counseling. And he thought up the notion of the moral obligation bond and the political device of securing them with tuition, since the legislature would not fail to appropriate tuition assistance, but they might fail to appropriate buildings. Very clever. We're doing a bit of that down here.
Same thing?
Yeah, very quiet. Not nearly as grandiose. But at any rate, it was obviously a wild gamble. The other resources beyond the metropolitan region, having the metropolitan mandate, or the outside of City University, proximity to Brookhaven is profoundly important, as you recognized instantly.
Right.
And so it turned out, which makes me feel especially badly that the university could not have been of more assistance to Brookhaven in their time of terminal grief. They deserve better from us than they got. More smarts. That's, to me, acutely embarrassing, because they blessed and launched...
You mean the Isabel problem?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's just a scandal, an indictment.
Did that happen after Johnny left, or while he was still there?
It was beginning to happen while he was there. In fact, I remember Frank mentioning some concerns about that. But the need for political intervention couldn't be reasonably identified until 1980 or so, I think. About right now, I was working in 79.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, nothing was done about it.
Nothing.
It has to be said that the initiation of the problem certainly was squarely attributable to Brookhaven, but greater shortcomings than that have been forgiven in this country when people insisted that it happened. But that, I'm afraid, was a pretty profound signal to you all out there. And having enjoyed so many benefits from the support of Brookhaven, the university and Sonny and the state owed them a lot, and they never got it.
Mm-hmm.
And we over here, I was over here by the time the party got really rough, and I was signaling frantically, I can deliver you two senators. I can do lots of things for you. And no one asked. There was just no effort. The Northeast deserves everything that happened to it in that decade. Most annoying.
I didn't know really much about what was going on.
Well, it was... that's a symptom of the problem. You should have known all about it. You should have been writing your congressman, but no one told anyone.
But at any rate, let's see. Oh, yes, why did one go there? That was one reason. Also, I thought the location, quite beyond the proximity of Brookhaven, was an extraordinary advantage. It is a very beautiful area. It was clear it was then just beyond the reach of suburbia. It was clear that was going to break at about the same time as the university went in, and that one could envision a shockingly middle-class sort of environment for attracting faculty to. And that's terribly important. One could see the reminiscences of Palo Alto and Pasadena and San Marino and that sort of business, which I think in the case of Stanford, for example, was quite crucial to their success. It was not the only reason they prospered so mightily, but they grew in exactly the period when they grew in quality in exactly the period when that sort of extension of the conventional 50s notion of the good life was very important to faculty, and it was important to the people that we attracted, I think. You recall how worried you were about everybody living in New York. Well, they gradually decided this is the place to be. Yeah,
by and large.
Yeah. Prices have gone sky high, so that's.
I resent that especially. I think we sold out at the wrong time.
Uh-huh.
Fortunately, our investment here is appreciated too.
Well, that's good.
Let's see. So, what other reasons? As I say, I was taken. Arne Feingold had a library of the key documents of the system from the late 50s and early 60s, and I was very greatly taken by the Heald report. I thought that was an extraordinary document. I figured one could fake the differences between it and the 1960 master plan for as long as they didn't really raise the question up there.
New York has so many resources, and New York City particularly, in terms of highly intelligent, experienced individuals. But the university, until Wharton got his last commission going, the university didn't seem to be tapping them. the way they should.
Well, I haven't seen that they seen any change in that. The city resources have been understandably continued to be a bit aloof as Stony Brook developed, simply because it was at that in those same years, and very late in the game, that they decided that City University had to become more of a public charge. But particular that, of course, is in any case an enormous resource. Just the people are but the particular version of opportunity that I saw in the simultaneous development of a university, of an ambitious research university, in the midst of a developing region. I'm talking now about Nassau, sir. Was that's really very rare. You do not often see an opportunity for an institution to put its stamp on a region. Stanford came along a little bit behind the development of the peninsula, although they certainly managed to put a stamp on what happened afterward. I thought that was an especially interesting opportunity. It was clear that there was going to be a complex and quasi independent, vastly interactive, but a discrete region was growing up at the same time that Stony Brook was to be built. And it was our conceit that Stony Brook had a very leading role to play in that.
I know you mentioned that. I've got some specific questions for you.
Oh.
This is a general set, but...
Oh, well, let me go on and knock off the general set. My understanding of my purpose and behind the creation of Stony Brook, I've already indicated some understanding of the documents and what I made of them. What was the vision being transformed into reality? Our vision was to create an extraordinarily powerful, singularly powerful state university. That was the department's vision, and that was our purpose. Impressions of Stony Brook when it first came, campus, people, leadership, the spirit. Well, of course, it was a tiny, tiny place. Everybody seemed unaccountably cheerful considering what had happened the year before. I don't know whether you agree that the shock seemed to expire fairly rapidly, at least among the people that I hung around with.
You were with a group that wanted to get on with the job of building the university. There was a group that felt, I think, somewhat out in the cold, and had been anti-Lee, pro-Austell, and Olson.
Why were they not happy since they succeeded in getting rid of Lee? Why did they not then,
I think,
turn to their agenda? Why didn't we hear more about their agenda?
I think they were, now this is purely my reaction after the fact. I think that the Chicago group was divisionally minded. There were no scientists among them, I don't think.
Well, there were a couple of biologists in there, but no, mainly you're right.
And
there were no scientists, that's right.
And somehow there was enough bitterness left over when I came. But I hadn't been in the office more than a couple of weeks. One man came in and said, "This place is going to go to the dogs unless you fire that person and that person." And there was enough friction in so that in committees, if one a representative of one group made a statement that was almost sure to be a countervailing statement from a representative of another group, quite irrespective of the value of the two statements.
I didn't really remember that. I guess my committee service was... Well, I served fairly steadily on the faculty executive committee or whatever they called it then, but I wasn't on a lot of task-oriented committees.
Well, I had to preside at one or two of them, and for a while, it held us up. But I think people became more and more exasperated at one or two individuals, Nelson in particular. And, we got on with
it for years.
I appreciated the statement that was signed by a group of the faculty, about 70. Who started that? You know.
I couldn't tell you. I think I remember it.
You remember
it? In fact, I think I have a copy of it in my papers.
I had to deal with representatives of the press who were looking for controversy.
Oh, yeah.
But I think I gradually got Martin Buskin turned around.
Well, he became quite a good friend of ours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yours, excuse me.
Okay.
Well,
Executive Vice President and, what's the other title?
Chief Academic Officer.
Chief Academic Officer.
Good. The reason that's not called provost is that, like we did at Stony Brook, we use provost differently here.
Mm-hmm.
The three campus principal people are called provosts.
I see.
Of the university.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm a central figure,
mm-hmm.
And they're campus figures.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it's a very poor arrangement because... our campus leaders are not recognized appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
They should be called presidents.
Yeah, right.
And the reason that they're not called presidents is that Blaustein can't be called chancellor because Ted Hollander is chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
And just the minute Ted Hollander moves, I'm going to advocate seizing the chancellorship.
Yeah.
Then I will become a vice chancellor.
Okay.
Now, or maybe even a province, who knows? I should live so long. As to events and persons and experience that stand out in my mind, maybe that should be the bulk of our discussion.
All right, let's, why don't we take over this group of questions from there.
My role in the planning and organization of the Department of Physics, well, I was the second chairman. Leonard, it was a department, I think, actually only for a year or two prior to my coming there. Leonard had no desire to continue in that. He couldn't get out of it fast enough. So they were recruiting for a chairman, and that turned out to be me. There was no plan, nor could there have been one. There was just enough written down to support a proposal for a PhD. There was a very good undergraduate program moving along with some quite good students, quite numerous good students. But there had been no thinking about what reach we should be planning for the department, nor had there been any opportunity to provide for the department's needs. Either in terms of physical resources or supporting personnel. You recall how much worry we shared on that issue.
Right.
Nor was there was the department very well plugged into the national research scene,
right. Right.
National physics.
This is when you came. This
yeah.
is as you found it.
Yeah. There was a little bit of grant support, Nandor Balaj and Jim Raz. There was an enormous amount of work to do. So we planned and planned and planned, and I must say, by and large, it almost, well, at about the 80% level, it worked out the way we intended. There was, of course, as there was in all departments, an intense amount of recruiting. The department went to meetings in a platoon, and every week we had at least a couple of people in, and we studied them intensely, and the main physical planning, we had some, I had some medium range, shortish range plans that could largely be accommodated in the physics building, the old physics building, metaphysics as it was lately called. I gather it may be called Harriman now. That's a terrible name for it. It's an insult to the great man. That was clearly temporizing. That kept us busy through the... it was possible to believe that the department could develop satisfactorily and be contained in the physics building until 1965 or 6 or 7 or so without really suffering from disaster. You must remember, we didn't get that building until 63. We spent the whole first year with no facilities whatsoever. Right. My graduate student had to work in Oyster Bay, which was, I have felt guilty about ever since. That was not very good for him, although he did get his PhD.
Was Les Pauldy in physics?
Not at that time. No, he had just graduated.
I see.
He was not a graduate. But the first thing we did was, well, along the way to temporizing and getting up and going, you may recall having to swat me away on various occasions on the importance of finishing the basement and then finishing the attic. And actually, Nelson Rockefeller's bomb shelter was also a historic investment. You recall he hit the panic button in 60. Edward Teller apparently scared the way out of him, and he ordered that bomb shelters be put in all public buildings when they were being built. Physics got one and chemistry didn't. But by the time 64 or so rolled around, no one was worrying about bomb shelters anymore. The cookies had all rotted. There was someone, Bob DeSaffer, I think, found a barrel in the basement about then that was a big, big industrial-sized barrel that was full of amphetamines. Absolutely full up to the top of amphetamines to give to the troops in case they were worrying about the nuclear disaster. But at any rate, that space, which was some 10 or 12,000 square feet, occurred singularly in the physics building because chemistry was built before, or was planned before physics. And that and our ability to finish off the attic, which was the other project that I then came around and beat your chops to, those were absolutely key because each of them we managed to make sure brought in equipment budgets of the order of $250,000 or so. So long after the first year we were there, we spent happily planning the expenditure of the order of $1 million for equipment of the old physics building before we moved into it. And that really got us going pretty well. But then the steam runs out of that, so those other little projects kept us perking until the big money began to come. The big first big piece of the plan, you may recall, was the notion that we should have a major research facility, and we did an analysis and concluded that it should be a tandem Van de Graaff.
Yeah.
And you may recall that kept growing.
I remember that one.
It finally got quite big, and it's still running. It has been a howling success. Because young Peter Paul, the current chairman of the department, came in as a pup on that machine and then ran it for several years. And at the crucial time when that generation of machines was beginning to lose its clout with the funding agencies, we came up with a modernization of it, the superconducting linear accelerator, heavy ion accelerator that is now in place. Let me tell you why that worked right now, because I'll forget by now. That was about 1974. One could see the handwriting on the wall. The machine had been around a decade at that point. And there were a dozen of them around the country, and the NSF was beginning to turn them off. There's one here, incidentally. That's a less happy story. I'm embarrassed to tell you. I got here too late to do anything about it. In fact, we examined the one here as a model. It was put in a year before ours. When we were designing the big building, the extension, no one noticed. We put in an enormous basement there. The basement of that building is about twice the size of the footprint above ground. And next to the Van de Graaff building, no one noticed that we put in, without any visible application, two enormous rooms with very thick walls. And when the competition to upgrade your FM tandem came in the middle 70s, the only way to win it was not to have to ask for a building, because the NSF didn't have enough money to fool around with that.
And you had the space.
Tapped the hole in the wall in. Just, I must say, I am as proud of that piece of planning as anything I've ever been involved in.
Well, I remember you're asking me to write a letter to Harry Porter about the Van de Graaff, which I did. And then you went down to Princeton and saw something that made you want to get
a bigger one,
the next generation.
Actually, it was down here.
Well,
that was Rutgers.
I see.
This is exactly...